This is Charles Morrissey on June 1, 1966, about to interview Ms. Margaret Coit for the John F. Kennedy Library. Oral History Project. This interview will be recorded in the sound studio of the National Archives Building in Washington, D.C.
The only trouble is I may forget one or two little things as I go along.
It's quite all right.
But,
well, you're the best judge to know where the beginning is. So why don't you start there?
Well, I had written my life of John C. Calhoun, and it had won the Pulitzer Prize. He didn't know that. I was a country girl. I lived in West Newbury, Massachusetts, population 1,400. And first time I'd ever come to New York, Bernard Baruch had called me down to write his official biography.
Mm-hmm.
I brought my mother along to chaperone me. I'd been to Washington a great deal doing research on Calhoun, but about New York, about the outside world, I knew very, very little.
When was this?
This was the spring of 1953.
Mm-hmm.
And I came down here to interview senators, practically all of them, because Baruch was friendly with everybody. And I'll be very frank with you, I had designs on John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in Massachusetts did. We had a Kennedy legend then, which was not like the legend you have now. But there was definitely a Kennedy legend. We didn't know much about him, but he was the golden boy. The most eligible bachelor in mm-hmm. New England. Every girl in Massachusetts wanted a date with him. And I wasn't any exception. And I thought up what possible excuse would I have to meet him. To interview him, because he was not a friend of Baruch's, although his father had been. And I talked with his father over the telephone. He'd frightened me to death, kind of barking at me, roaring at me.
Uh-huh.
But I had read Why England Slept, and I decided, I was doing Baruch and his times, that the good excuse would be to see Kennedy and get the feeling of Europe. At the time Baruch was over there, warning that war was going to come, that Germany would win it. Baruch and Joseph Kennedy agreed absolutely that England and France would go down because they were so completely unprepared, and I knew that Kennedy was over there as a young man enjoying the last of it, the last golden days before the war came. So I made up my mind that was the excuse upon which I wanted to interview him, that I wanted to get the feeling of those days just mm-hmm. before World War II broke out. But in getting ready for the interview, I got dressed up. I had on a little gray silk suit, I remember every detail of it, and pink lace gloves, and a little gray bonnet with a pink lace veil and a pink rose. So he got the idea right away. Well, anyway, I went around to his office. It was just about this time of year. In fact, I think it was about 2 weeks earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very hot, terribly hot.
This is his office here in Washington?
It was his office in the Senate office building. He didn't rate an air-conditioned office then, or even a good one. Oh, can you cut it off?
Sure.
I went around to his office, and I'd had the appointment. I was staying over on Southeast 6th Street at the time. And I'd interviewed a great many senators before him, including Symington, who seemed just seething with ambition.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he seemed just obsessed with being president. This is important because of something that happened later. And Byrd, who seemed the cleverest and shrewdest politician I'd ever seen. And Taft, the most dedicated.
Mm-hmm.
And Langer, the most stupid.
Really?
These were some of the ones that I had been interviewing. In fact, I'd interviewed a great many stupid senators. You'd be surprised how many stupid ones there were, and I suppose are. They weren't remarkable for intellect. Well, anyway, I went into Kennedy's outer office. There were six girls in there, I recall, none especially pretty or chic or young. And copies of the Boston Post all around. And then I saw him for the first time, and my overwhelming impression was of something gray.
Hmm.
His eyes were gray, and his suit was gray, and his hair was as gray as yours at that time. His lips were gray, and his skin had a grayish tinge. The only bit of his eyeballs were very, very white. He had very piercing eyes, and a hard, harsh kind of voice. Small, stubby, fingered hands. Those were my immediate impressions. And he looked me searchingly and through, and then sat down with me and talked to me about what I wanted him to talk about, which was that period of England just before the war broke out. And I took down my notes, but all the while he was looking me over, just looking me right over and through. And finally he said, I'm going to be giving a party around at my house in Georgetown in a couple of days. Do you want to come? Did I? I just jumped at that idea. So I left, and 2 or 3 days later I got in a taxi and went over to the party. I think it was the little house, maybe where he lived when he first married Jacqueline. I don't know, a very small house, as I recall, with a hallway that you came in and two reception rooms. Well, I went into that party. It was full of people. And Kennedy was there. He greeted me. And the party lasted 2 or 3 hours, and he got into a corner with Senator Stuart Symington and never spoke to anybody for the whole party. To me or anybody else. And I didn't know anyone. I wandered around. His brother Bobby came down the stairs with Ethel. They'd been married 2 years, I think. They had a little one-year-old. Ethel looked like a little doll with a big round bouffant skirt. The prettiest little thing you ever saw. His sisters were there, looking very dashing and high style. And one of them said, oh, I know your Calhoun. It's a marvelous book. And their hair was frosted. It's the first time I'd seen frosting on hair. And they spoke to me. Finally, I saw somebody I knew, and I gave a gulp, and he gave a gulp, and he said, I won't tell on you if you don't tell on me, because I'd come down to Washington as a delegate to a group of Republican women, and I had met this gentleman the night before at the Republican gathering. It was Richard Nixon.
Well, isn't that a coincidence?
And the only other person I saw that I knew, I had also met at the Republican gathering the night before, and that was Alice Longworth in a big black hat. And having nothing else to do, I remember I ate up a whole bowl of shrimps and sour cream. Nobody paying any attention to me, whatever. And finally, Bobby got hold of me. And I went into a room with him, and I remember thinking of the contrast between him and his brother, because he was ruddy and warm and full of fun and jokes, and he knew my book, and he was very friendly, and I liked him very, very much, and I don't remember what we talked about, but it was very pleasant. And suddenly, toward the end of the party, Kennedy took some notice of me and came over. In fact, he grabbed me in the hall, kind of put his arm around my waist and said, isn't she the prettiest little thing you ever did see, or something like that, embarrassed the life out of me. And his sisters had said, oh, we do wish you'd meet some nice girl. And then Kennedy said, I can't take you home. I have to fly, I think he said, to Chicago. So I'm going to send you home with the mayor of San Diego. So he sent me home with the mayor of San Diego. And he said, I'll call you in 2 or 3 days and we'll have a date. Well, at that time I was working over in the manuscript division of the Library of Congress. So I waited, two or three days later, they said, someone's calling you. Very New England accent. And I went and got on the telephone, and it was Kennedy. And he said, would you come over to the office and meet me there about 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon? So I went over and went into his office, and he was sitting at the desk signing letters and glamour boy pictures of himself, hundreds of them. And I had a lot of time. I sat on a sofa and just looked around. There were framed letters from Daniel Webster and framed letters from Andrew Jackson, and many pictures of him and casual offhand poses with everybody from Harry Truman on down. And then I began looking at the books. The walls were lined with books. I'd walk around and look at the books. And he threw back his head and said, try me on them. I've read them all. And it got hotter and hotter and hotter, and he stood up, began to scratch. He scratched and scratched till his shirt was out all the way around. He had a foot up here, and he was chewing gum and stringing it back and forth and barking into a telephone and doing something very nice for some high school youngsters who were coming here once. And meanwhile, the signing went on and on and on and on. And once in a while, he would shoot a question at me. Once it was about Bernard Baruch. Why was I doing the book? Once it was something very penetrating about Claire Booth Luce's private life. And a little malicious. And at another point he said, don't you see how hard a senator works? I said, I do. And the signing went on. And finally, he finished it. He came over and sat beside me on the love seat and put back his head. And suddenly, I got frightened out of my wits because he nearly passed out. It was as if all the energy had drained out of him, as if you'd emptied a bottle of water and turned it upside down on the floor. He just looked more gray than ever, and his eyes were closed, and I thought he was going to faint, and I was so scared I didn't know what to do. It was late. Everybody had gone home. It must have been around 6. The secretaries had gone. I was alone there. We just sat there, and finally I said, I think you're too tired to take me out tonight. Why don't you take me home? And he said, you're very kind. I will take you home. I had noticed the crutches against the wall of the office. And he took them now. And we walked down through the corridors of the empty Senate office building. And as we came out, he took a stick of Juicy Fruit chewing gum out of his pocket. Said, you want some? I said, okay. And he tore off half the piece and poked it into my mouth. Then we went around and got his car. It was a little open, topless convertible, absolutely all jammed up and dented and marked, and it had a member of Congress on it, not senator. Oh, and one other point I forgot. He looked so much older than he was. That, to me, was one of the strange discrepancies, because in his pictures he looked so young. He was about 34 or 5 at this time, I should imagine, and he looked 45. And we got into the car, and he drove on the streetcar tracks in front of the bus, or the streetcar that was coming along, and the streetcar would toot at him, and he'd lean out and swear at it. And we went along. It was a wild ride.
Did he say anything about his back hurting him?
Not a word. Not a word. He didn't say anything about anything, except that he was very tired, and he would take me home. Well, I was staying at kind of an old-fashioned, rather run-down rooming house in the southeast section of Washington, where I made my mistake was inviting him in. There was a living room. I thought he'd like to rest a few minutes. And beyond it, a bedroom. You could see the bed. And we went in and sat down, and he threw himself down on the sofa. It seemed all right to me. And then he tried to drag me down beside him. So I struggled, and I said, wait a minute. I made up my mind I wasn't going to kiss you on the first date. And he said, this isn't a first date. We've been making eyes at each other 3 times now. And then he lunged for me, and I said, let me talk to you. I said, I have standards just like your sister. Don't you think those are good standards? Yes, he said, but without much conviction. You wouldn't want me to do anything you wouldn't want your sister to do, would you? I don't care what they do, he said. Then he sort of tugged at me, and I began to cry. And then I said, look what you'll have to tell the priest. Oh, I'll have to tell him your name, he said, but he'll forgive me, all right. And he gave a giggle and grinned. I rose and got up to get a glass of water. He watched me. You have pretty legs, he said. You have pretty sisters, I said. That's not a fair exchange, he said. Well, you're not bad looking for a senator, I said. Seeing that was what he wanted. He looked very rueful. Then he sprang up. He grabbed me. I'm sad, I'm gay, I'm melancholy, I'm gloomy, I'm all mixed up and I don't know how I am, he said. He was wild, he was black Irish, and he sort of grappled with me. Don't, I said, don't be so grabby. This is only our first date. We've got plenty of time. He lifted his head and his gray eyes just drilled into mine. But I can't wait, you see, he said. You see, I haven't any time. Then we got fighting and arguing again, he looking at me as if he were dissecting me in a laboratory kind of way. What frightened me was so he was like a machine. He was so cold, and it was as if he'd shifted gears. We had been talking about books and ideas and my concepts of the books on Baruch, and then he'd seen me as one kind of person. He'd seen me as a mind, and now he saw me just as something female. And he couldn't fit the two together. And it was as if he were two parts. He was like a 14-year-old high school football player on the make, and he was like an elder statesman of 60 in his intellectual processes. The two together. And it was the cold, machine-like quality that scared me so. And I've got to skip some of this. At one place, after a while, he made me kiss him, and he said, "Darling," dreamily, and I said, "That's the first gentle word you've ever said to me." And he said, "How'd you like a husband who was harsh to you first and gentle to you afterwards?" Grinning with all his white teeth. "How would you like a husband who beat you every morning?" My friend said I shouldn't tell about this. "I'd bite him," I said. I said, "Now, you know what you are? You're a spoiled Irish Mick on the make." And he looked at me and he said, "You're a spoiled Irish bastard." And then we began to laugh. And we laughed and laughed and laughed. And he said, "I won't bother you. Do you want to go out for a ride?" I said, "Sure. I'll go out riding with you." We got into the car, and we started riding. And then he suddenly said, "My brother Bobby told me you'd won the Pulitzer Prize. You never told me that. You're very modest. Very modest. Tell me, you know, I would rather win a Pulitzer Prize than be President of the United States." And he said, "Tell me something else. How did Bernard Baruch make his money?" And I said, "Pretty much the way your own father made his, I would imagine. Why don't you ask him?" He said, "I want to make millions. I'm going to outdo my father." He was driven. He was the most driven person I'd ever seen in my life. We went by the White House, and he looked at it without a smile. It was grim and it was gray, and he said, between his teeth, "I am going to go there." And then he said, "Do you think I have the drive of Andrew Jackson?" All I thought was that he was kind of crazy. I think he frightened me more than the facts warranted. Mm-hmm. He just was a little out of my league. It was the coldness that frightened me. I'd been with wolves before, and he knew now what I meant, and he knew how to accept it. But it was the coldness that frightened me, and the fact that he was out of a much more sophisticated background than anything I knew how to cope with or handle. And I just wanted out of there. And he finally brought me back and said goodbye and said, "I'll call you." I was afraid he would. And I got out of Washington as soon as I could because I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't quite know how to cope. And I went home. Every mother in Massachusetts would have liked her daughter to have John F. Kennedy show some interest in her. My mother said, "You were a fool. You should have known how to handle him better." I said, "I don't know how to handle somebody like that. And anyway, he wouldn't be interested in me. He'll marry somebody who isn't as much like him as I am. He'll marry someone who's very different, who can do things for him that I couldn't do. He likes the same things I like. He has a marvelous mind. He's read all those books. And also he'll marry somebody in his own faith, I believe." Mm-hmm. But then I got word from the manuscript division of the Library of Congress that he called day after day. They said at least someone called, didn't say who it was, high-pitched voice, very New England. I knew who it was. Well, he had told me to read The Young Marlborough. So I went home and read The Young Marlborough. Let's shut off now. "Dear John Kennedy, The Young Marlborough was great fun, and I'm glad you told me to read it. Too romantic, though, all suffused in the soft glow of candlelight. The 18th century was not all a beau monde, I know. I have some chapters of an 18th century novel in at Houghton Mifflin, which they'll publish sometime. Forever England is the tentative title. They think not. But who am I to tell you what I don't know about England would fill 20 books? Philosophically, I thought the Marlborough was fascinating. Take warning, though. Quote, politics is a life sentence to hard labor." Unquote. "Do you know the characterization of William Lamb seems to embody the paradox, the division of the English character? I think people look on the British as realistic, not romantic, in the sense the Irish are. Yet what could have been more extravagantly romantic than Nelson or Disraeli? And doesn't Churchill on the beachheads compare with Lamb and his vision of the Armada? I liked Mr. Lamb's philosophies on marriage. Alas, the New York Herald Tribune charged me with not having rosy views on that subject. Although I was once romantic enough to think that the Byron, Carol, and Lamb story would make a wonderful color movie for the Oliviers. But I liked also Lamb's reflection that unless people discover the truth about each other, they'll never get on, and certainly not if they wed under a romantic delusion. Also his reflections that life is a comedy, men are fools, and that there is no use risking an immediate disturbance for the sake of a problematic future goal. But I challenge the view that cynics do not like people. Is it not the disillusioned idealists who come to hate, and the cynics or realists not expecting too much who love the good they do find? By the way, Mr. Baroop has just delivered himself of an address endeavoring to show, as this book does, the creed of conservatism, that the old system can accomplish new reforms. Freedom, he says, is not a privilege but a responsibility, not synonymous with license but restraint. Both he and Calhoun saw the world realistically, but he adapted to it. Calhoun would only battle it. And you wanted to know how Baroop made his money. Perhaps I will tell you sometime. Right now I feel like Carl Sandburg when asked to explain Abraham Lincoln. I thought I got that across, he said, in about a million words. This much I can tell you right now. Baroop always said that money-making is a full-time job. You can't combine it with statecraft. Of course, he has made money since becoming a statesman, but only as a kind of conditioned reflex. Furthermore, the money-making job is five times as difficult today as when he made his millions. Do you know Canning? Is there a book on him you would recommend? He intrigues me. Maybe I should write one. No, perhaps your idea was better, to put you in a book. Or better still, how about one on the whole family, three generations? Your mother is beautiful. I see where you all get your looks. As for you, I believe you do have the drive to be president, and the dignity on occasion, and the brains, and these will provide the momentum. But who knows where the wild horse will run? There is more in luck and fate than we think. And we can do no more than turn it loose. If you know what you want, you may get it, and then not want it, as I found out. None of the strange and wonderful things that have happened to me would have ever happened had I not written Calhoun. But was it not destiny that Swopewood should give Baroop a copy, and he should read it to his nurse while she rubbed him down, and then put in a call to me, without which I would never have been visiting senators in Washington, finding out about Mr. Baroop, to say nothing of enlarging my education? So where will that great speech you made the other day take you? That is up to fate, and so is the future of your brother, whom the country owes much for his research work on English treachery. I liked him. Please remember me to him. It was great fun, too, getting acquainted with you, even with our differences of opinion. I wonder now what you will think of my Calhoun. And this brings me to two things I forgot. One is, he said, why don't you write a book about me? I said, he said, what I'm interested in is me. Why don't you write a book about me? I said, you're not important enough yet. He said, well, you could put me in a book. Presidents, people I have known. Men I have known.
Did you discuss writing a book about the whole Kennedy family?
Just in this letter. That was an idea that had just occurred to me. And it was just in that letter. Now, there's one other thing I forgot. After I had seen him, I went away pretty angry. But I saw Arthur Kruk the next day. And Arthur Kruk said, who have you been seeing in Washington? And I told him all the people I'd been seeing. And he said, John Kennedy, what a tragedy that boy is. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, don't you know he's going to die? And I said, what are you talking about? He said, his father told me that he had only 4 years to live. And that began to explain a lot. That explained a lot to me, particularly those things. I'm going to grab everything I want. You see, I haven't any time. There's not so much more.
What's the reference in that letter to a speech he had given?
I can't remember what speech. I remember at the time it must have struck me as important. And interesting.
You told me you didn't date that letter?
No, but you can tell by the one dated letter he wrote to me.
Mm-hmm.
No, the letter isn't dated.
Uh-huh.
And then, now this is the interesting thing. I didn't hear from him again. The next time I saw him, I think he might have won his Pulitzer Prize by that time. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, he spoke before the National Book Award people.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in to see him, and I'd been sick. And I was so thin, he didn't recognize me for a moment. And then he did recognize
mm-hmm.
me and acted very pleased to see me. By that time, he had listed Calhoun as one of his 10 favorite books. But he was only a senator then.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't too much notice taken of it. But it was a little squib in the New York Times about it. Later, when he became president and went on listing it, then, of course, it was good for big sales and there was
yeah.
a great deal of notice made of it. Well, then the funny thing is, I saw him again, once more, before he became president. I think it was in 1958. And I went down to Washington. And I sent in my card. And he came off the Senate floor to talk to me. And the change was incredible.
Hmm.
His face was ruddy, and it fell out. His hair was reddish brown, and no longer gray.
Hmm.
And instead of being so cold and machine-like, he was warm and human. And I wondered if it had something to do with his marriage to Jacqueline. Oh, one funny thing in the office, the day I was waiting in with him all those hours, someone called Jackie, called up, and he told this person off rather harshly.
Hmm.
And I thought it was a man. Jackie, I don't want to be bothered now. Let me alone, or something of that. And I thought to myself, I wouldn't like to be talked to that way. And then I got the feeling later, however, that the marriage, the children, all this had changed him. It humanized him.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't seem like a machine anymore. And when it came to 1960, well, I was a Republican and I was trying to make up my mind who to vote for. I talked with Nixon about Toynbee. He had read all of Toynbee.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought of the two. And I finally thought, Nixon is a great mind, and Kennedy is a genius. And I voted for Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. Did you support him publicly?
It wouldn't have made any difference if I had. I mean, I was known as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Where I could, I did, yes. Now, I think that, unless you have questions now, you want to ask.
Just a couple. I'm surprised that he had not heard of your Calhoun biography before he met you.
Bobby had, and the sisters had.
Uh-huh.
I'm a little surprised, too.
Because he used to read history and biography constantly.
I think the reason is he didn't like Calhoun
mm-hmm.
as a person.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Daniel Webster man.
Mm-hmm.
And he might not have read it under his own power.
Did he ever talk to you about the selection of the 5 outstanding senators that he handled?
I didn't know he was in charge of that.
Yeah, I forget the year, but he was the chairman of a Senate-established committee to choose these 5 senators. Taft, La Follette, Norris, 2 others I can't remember at this time.
Oh, Calhoun.
Calhoun, and was Webster the 5th one?
Yeah. Yes.
I wasn't sure of that. I'm surprised he didn't talk to you about Calhoun with respect to that assignment he had.
We didn't.
Yeah.
He told me the last time he saw me, he said, the next time you come to Washington, we'll have lunch.
Mm-hmm.
But the next time I came to Washington, he was president. And I never tried to see him
mm-hmm.
then.
Do you know if he read your Baruch book?
Yes. He listed it, too.
Uh-huh.
He listed it as one of his favorite books of the year,
uh-huh.
the year it came out. And he listed Calhoun as one of the main sources that he drew upon for profiles in Courage.
Mm-hmm. Did you review that book?
No, I wasn't given it to review. I've been quite a reviewer lately. I've been reviewing books on Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
I reviewed Sorensen's Kennedy for the Saturday Review.
Well, I wonder if there is anything we're overlooking. I can't think of any other questions. If there is anything, you can always add it to the transcript of the tape.
It was just, there was such, he was such a strange combination. So immature, mm-hmm. emotionally, so mature, intellectually. It was almost frightening, the discrepancy between the two halves.
Uh-huh.
And this sense that he wasn't going to last very long.
Mm-hmm. Did you interview his father for the Baruch volume?
Just over the telephone. And his father frightened me so that I didn't dare go down to see him.
Mm-hmm.
He was very harsh, rude.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't interview him.
Could you tell me a little bit about that handwriting analysis that you did?
They have it in the other room.
Why don't I get it?
How much this is as, how valuable it is, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a few other little things to show you that were in the briefcase. Let's see, anything else in here. Where is it? Oh, yeah. There's another analysis of it.
Hmm.
I think I did it twice.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things on here are even more interesting. Then this one person I told about my encounter in New York and didn't mention the name of the person. This note is dated, I think.
Mm.
May 7th, 1953. I don't know that I have the two things here. Analysis of Senator John F. Kennedy's handwriting, it says here.
Is there a date on it?
No. Selfish. Generous. They're both in there. I'll just... Lack of scientific and analytical. Good reasoning power. A real person worth knowing. Scholar. Concentration. Critical ability. Culture. Judgment. Rare intellect. Keen judgment and critical sense. Quote, no person of ordinary ability ever writes this way.
Hmm.
The comparison of small vertical script shows respect for detail and a mental equipment far above the average. Strong personality, clear logical thinker, thorough analytical mind. Often it repeats, you see. Capable of great things. A leader in thought. Energetic, always planning schemes. A mental dynamo. He had this restless, impatient energy. Everything he did was sudden and abrupt. With me, when he jumped at me, it was just as if he'd shifted a gear,
mm-hmm.
going from one thing to another, with no time, no build-up, no preparation. Just like that. Materialistic, self-confidence, sensuous, fond of the outdoors and sex. Tactful, shrewd, a clever bargainer. Secretive. Original, distinctive personality, fixed opinions, and brilliant ideas. Spoiled, extremely irritable, if things not as he wants them. Energetic, adaptable to circumstances. Procrastinator, impulsive, quick, irritable. And then different things here. I analyzed
mm-hmm.
it twice.
Mm-hmm. Is that a hobby of yours?
It was. I don't
uh-huh.
even have the book now.
Uh-huh.
Do these show some of the same?
Very, very similar, yeah. Well, very good. And thank you very much for everything. You've been very kind.
Memories of Nixon, but that isn't from where. Because I met him under other circumstances.
Uh-huh.
Different way.
Do you want to tell me the afterthought about Stuart Symington?
Yes, this was it. But it's just a theory I had. It's just a theory. And of course, again, it didn't come to me till after I'd had that real date with Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
The whole party, at this party he invited me to, he didn't pay any attention to any of the guests whatsoever. And he stayed in that corner for 2.5 or 3 hours, talking to Symington the entire time. And later on, when he told me he was going to be president, and all this, I concluded that there was something working between him and Symington some plan for 1956.
Hmm.
Something about being on the ticket. There was something going on in between.
Hmm.
Symington was just as, even if possible, even more seething with ambition. It was the whole impression you got.
Uh-huh.
That's all. Mm-hmm. It's just a little bit.
Well, thank you.